Fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
This is Part-Time Fanboy. I am Christian. I am here with Paul and Ian, and we are joined by Mark L. Miller, who is the editor-in-chief of the Ain't It Cool News comics section and the horror section as well. And he's also an established comic book writer. So the subject for this week was going to be we were basically going to go over how a lot of high-profile professional comic book writers and artists are kind of abandoning DC and Marvel to go off and do their own creator-owned stuff. I did a Google search a little earlier today, and I just typed in creators leaving to do their own creator-owned books, and a lot of stuff came up, like a lot. And I guess the biggest one that I knew about was Ed Brubaker kind of leaving Captain America, and he's saying he's going off to do his own stuff, but I don't think it's been publicized as to what he's doing. Any thoughts on your guys' end as to...
Well, I think he's only staying on Winter Soldier, right?
Is he? I thought he was leaving Marvel altogether.
I think he's staying just on Winter Soldier. That's the only thing he's going to be doing. And that must mean he has some kind of stake in that character.
Oh, you think so? Because he created it, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Grant Morrison is leaving the Superman books, right? Or he's leaving Action and Batman Incorporated, correct?
Is he?
Yeah, that's... is he?
That was like in the news. He bounces around between DC and Marvel, so it would be interesting to see if he did something on his own.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if Brubaker's going to be working through the Icon imprint like Bendis does, or if he's going to go off to Image and stuff like that. I haven't really heard anything. But it just seems like this is a big trend in a lot of big creators, you know, dumping the big two and going off on their own, which I guess in the end seems to be a lot more lucrative for them. But, I mean, you're not really necessarily getting paid up front for your work, as far as I understand it, with a lot of companies, right?
No, but I think that, I don't know. I think that if you're a name like Brubaker or I mean, especially Grant Morrison, I think you're going to be, has to be some type of incentive to come over there to Image. I guess Grant Morrison has a book called Happy coming out through Image.
Oh, really?
I think it's called Happy or something like that. But it's a new title from him. And Bendis as well, I'm sure. I've never seen him go anywhere outside of Marvel lately, but I don't know if that's coming or not. But it does seem like with the Millar World stuff and with Bendis, that is the trend that all the big names are going. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that. I think it makes me kind of sad for the Marvel characters and the DC characters because it's going to be hard. I guess it's just time for a new crop of writers to come up and really step up to their game and write these comics well. At least that's what I hope.
Yeah. I don't know. It's really interesting to me because the trend, like, in the late 90s and early 2000s, you would see, like, I think Grant Morrison or Garth Ennis on Comic Book Resources, they had columns, and they were constantly trashing the big two in those columns. They were constantly saying, like, go out, create your own stuff, make your own footprint and stuff like that. And then, you know, for the years after that, you would see them jumping on board to the big two, almost like they had never written those articles. And it was really strange. And now it seems like the balance is shifting back towards, you know, creator-owned stuff, which has stuff gotten so much worse at the big two that they just want to jump ship? Or is it just that they're seeing a lot of these movie deals get picked up? I mean, you know, it seems odd.
That's a good point. That's a good point, Christian, because when Image happened, that push was a crop of writers and mostly artists. They went to just form their own company, right? This is different where these artists are leaving and pretty much saying they're going solo, right?
Yeah, but I think Mark may be right in that, you know, they've got to have some incentive. They can't just be jumping ship on their, you know, there's got to be some sort of, I wonder if they have some sort of deal with it, some sort of special deal with Image, because from what
You know, there's a lot more money to be made in movies than there is in comics. And I know that Morrison's been making a push toward movies for a while. And so I know that he's got the dinosaurs and aliens thing that he's trying to get off the ground with. It's Barry Sonnenfeld, right?
Yeah.
And oh, really?
So, yeah. So there's that, too. But I think it's a lot easier now, too, for people to sort of do their own thing and make money with it.
Yeah.
Well, if you're Grant Morrison or if you're Baker, you know, these guys, the thing is, this all goes back to kind of like that Kirkman manifesto that he wrote a while back about how creators should stop going to the big two and go out and strike out on their own. And that's great for someone who is like Robert Kirkman to say. But the thing is, there are, for every Robert Kirkman, there are a million writers out there, a million artists out there trying to establish themselves. And it shouldn't be seen as a bad thing that they go to Marvel or DC or any other comic company out there that's a little more independent than that, in writing for scale and not owning the stories that you have, because that's the only way you can really break into this business without, I mean, shy of having a book deal, shy of having a coming from another venue, like being a movie star and someone wanting you to write for their books. It just seems like it's not a realistic way of looking at things. I don't think writers who are not the blockbuster level should be really listening to what Kirkman has to say.
I mean, do you really think that that's the only way to, like, push through, though? Because, I mean, maybe not. I guess it depends on what is the final goal. Are you just trying to make good comics, or are you trying to make something that gets into movies? Because I remember that, I think it was Grant Morrison in one of his columns, you know, the big thing is, like, if you're going to make comics, you got to make comics. Like, you can't do it with the end goal of, like, I'm going to be a bajillionaire like Todd McFarlane, because those days are gone, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, if you're going to make comics, you have to make them because you love them, because they're not easy to make. It's hard to put them together. The print costs are expensive if you're going to try and, you know, if you're going to self-publish. So, I mean, you really have to love it. So do you think that the only way to really get attention is to jump in to because it seems like this is the path. You start, like, independently, and you're doing your own, like, little indie book, and, you know, maybe it's cell phone, maybe it's not, or whatever. And then Marvel or DC take notice. Like, you can't, it doesn't seem like you can submit directly to Marvel or DC. You have to sort of be self-publishing, doing your own thing. And then Marvel or DC, what's that?
Or I think you have to be kind of like a friend. You have to be kind of like in the in crowd. Because look how Ron Zimmerman got work, and Chuck Austin got work. It's like, yeah, they were screenwriters, yes, but they were friends. Like, it seemed like it was the same thing with I kind of see that as the same thing with Judd Winnick and Pete Tomasi, who was a fantastic editor and is a fantastic writer. I think that without the push of from Jeff Johns, I think it would have been harder for him to break out into his own and do the work that he has been doing, just because it seems like they're all really good friends.
Yeah, yeah.
At least from the outside. Who knows? They might hate each other's
names. Yeah, but don't you... I mean, at the same time, but that's kind of... when you read, like, the old history of Marvel, like the bullpen and stuff, it always was, like, working up through the ranks. Like, even Paul, when we went to go see the Michael Uslan panel, mm-hmm. like, he was saying that he started, like, working at DC as, you know, he was teaching a course in comics at a university, and they took notice of that, like, in the news, and then they brought him in as a consultant, and then he started kind of writing small stories, and he got a chance to write a Shadow story, and he was, like, wandering through the halls, and one day, you know, the Batman editor was like, oh, that Shadow story didn't suck. Hey, do you want to write Batman? You know, I mean, I think that's almost for, like, every industry, isn't it? You got to be at the right place at the right time.
The right place and the right time is constantly changing and shifting. You're never going to get in the same way as anyone else.
Yeah.
No one ever does. Even in, I love reading stories actually, about the music industry, about how different bands made it to where they were. Every single story is different, and it's always unique, and it's always interesting. But actually going back, Christian, to what you said about just applying your trade, if you're not going to do it in a bullpen situation, which those I'm not even sure if those really exist anymore. Everyone's pretty much seems like they're – am I wrong to think that everyone's working from home and digitally sending their work in? Is that right?
I think you're right, yeah.
I mean, so that takes a different kind of I think work ethic in a way. I remember at school visual arts, I had an illustration teacher, and one of his things was working with his baby, you know, next to his illustration desk, and that's what got him motivated, he said, to pretty much go every day. Whereas in the bullpen days, and this actually references the 10-cent plague book we talked about a while back, you needed that work bad, and you had to report to those studios to, and that's where you did the work. So it's a different, ever-changing situation, like Paul's saying. And if people could make their buck going solo with off the experience they have, more power to them, especially now, because if they've got some special projects in their back of their head that's graphic novel oriented, chances are it will get picked up for a movie. Whereas a few years before, that just wasn't happening.
Yeah.
I think right now everybody's kind of following the same path as Kirkman with The Walking Dead, but that in itself is not going to be repeatable. I don't think there's not going to be a. I mean, this is a black and white comic about zombies, which has been kind of like run through the ringer, and it's one of the biggest selling comics, independent comics out there, and it's got a hit TV show and everything. But I don't know if. His rise to fame is not going to be the same as what he's trying to map out for other people with that with that letter. Do you guys remember reading that letter, like that he wrote?
Oh, I remember. I thought it was really inspirational, obviously, but I think that you are absolutely correct in what you're saying. But I think that's almost like with any industry. I mean, if you talk about acting, you talk about musicians. Don't you think that there's always going to be like look at sort of something like Men in Black. Like, that was a comic. Didn't Marvel or somebody put... That was, like, a really obscure book that came from nowhere, you know?
Yeah,
and
it was, like, Malibu or something.
Was it Malibu? Yeah. Maybe I was confused. But I'm just saying, like, something like Men in Black... I mean, I haven't read any stories about what the creator of Men in Black is getting from those movies, but he's got to be getting something, because from what I understand, it was a creator-owned book, right? Or I could be wrong. But I think it's just, like, almost any other industry. You've got to, like, apply your craft... You've got to work your ass off, and you've got to shuffle, you know. And while Kirkman, and I think that, I'm sorry, Mark, you were saying something?
No.
Oh, no, I think when Kirkman comes out, because I think it's very, whether it's Marvel, DC, any corporate-owned entity, they very much want to be like the big only players on the block. They very much want to be like, you can only come through us. Like, we're the gateway.
Oh, yeah, that's the whole thing about them trademarking superhero.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they trademark the term superhero so nobody else can use it. But I think that, oh, that's been around for a long time. And nobody can fight it because they've got so much money. But my whole thing is I think that to a certain extent, they love perpetuating that myth. You know what I mean? And the thing is part of... I had listened to an interview with Rob Liefeld on Word Balloon. Don't ask me why. I was just curious.
Why not?
Well, cool. I was curious. I just wanted to see, like, what he had to say for himself. Yeah. And it was, like, an hour-long interview. And, you know, the guy, he's been through the superstar thing. And he said something about, he was saying something about Marvel, which is basically that, you know, anyone who's writing the X-Men books or when he was writing, or he had a stint on the X-Men books a couple of years ago or a couple of months ago, he was saying that a lot of creators and a lot of artists are refusing to create new characters, like, because they don't want their brand new creations to, be used for Marvel, because then Marvel just owns it outright. What they're trying to do...
Or you end up in one of those situations like Neil Gaiman did with the Angela series that he did in Spawn.
Oh, yeah, with the whole lawsuit thing where it went on for years and years. You know, but I mean, that's sort of the thing. And part of what he was saying is that's why you see like these weird sort of Marvel books, because it's like, why is that character here? And it's because they're kind of shoehorning like other characters into stories where they might not necessarily what they might not be perfect for. Well, where maybe you might want to make a brand new character out of whole cloth. And a lot of creators don't want to do that because they see that they're not necessarily going to get ripped off, but, you know, they're not going to get the rewards that they could get if this was theirs, like 100%, right?
I mean, I'm sure Rob is kind of kicking himself because I'm sure he doesn't own any part of Deadpool, but now it's like there are a million Deadpool books and everybody loves that character and talk of a movie and all of that stuff. And I'm sure that between that, Shatterstar, Cable, all of those things, those are ones that he could have really seen a profit on had he done the contract or whatever. I don't know. They probably don't even offer that type of contract anymore.
I think that probably right now what DC and Marvel offer is kind of a piece of the pie, but I think it's built on residuals, like sales, like how much something sells. So, because I've heard creators talk about like that they got like a huge check in the mail from something that they created in the 70s or 80s, and they were just like, oh, wow, you know, and maybe those were just deals that started happening when, you know, the sort of creator rights revolution was happening. But I just think it's really interesting that a lot of these big name creators, Brubaker especially, because he's huge, and his Captain America run, I mean, I haven't stayed on it. I think you have, Mark. Have you been reading?
Yeah, I've been reading it. It's good, but it's just not the level of what it used to be. You can tell he's really not into it.
Oh, really?
His Captain America and even his Winter Soldier. It's ever since Cap kind of came back. It seems like that series has kind of just been floundering all over the place. But it's not great, but it's not terrible. It's just kind of a mid-tier book.
Yeah. I mean, we're all sort of in our own way kind of trying to create our own media. And it's like, I don't know, that's the big question. If Marvel or DC, you know, in a fantasy universe, I mean, Mark, is that something that, like, because you're writing books. I mean, you've got stuff with Xenoscope and what was the other company that with Luna?
I'm working with Famous Monsters. And I do own most of Luna.
Great.
In the contract, we have my co-writer and I own that property and everything. So, who knows what'll happen with that? It's getting published later on in this year from Hermes Press, I believe. It's like a subsidiary of Random House, which is kind of cool. But when I was working at Blue Water, it's like they've taken a lot of flack for not paying their artists, for not paying their writers. And to be honest, you know, I never saw any money from my work there. I wrote like 12 issues with that company. But what it did was it gave me something to hold in my hand and give to someone else and say, hey, I wrote this, check this out.
Sure.
And I did that, and that led to me working at Xenoscope right now, and now I'm being paid for my work that I'm doing for them. So it's definitely, it's a stepping stone. I know that people don't want to hear that oh my god, you wrote this story, you put all these hours into it, and you worked for free. But the thing is, you have to look at it as a big picture. I kind of see it as that was my internship at Blue Water when I wasn't being paid, but I was really learning how to do like what was going on. I learned to kind of like try to get in on deadlines and everything. And then you just kind of work yourself up, and then all of a sudden you get a paying job, and it's not a great paying job, but it's money. And then you go on in the profession, and the longer you go, the better you get, hopefully. That's when the pay increases. I mean, that's just the way it is in any profession. And so I don't think this kind of like superstar rise to fame that a lot of people are expecting, it happens. It's like 1 in a million chance of that happening.
Yeah.
Right. And you, it's something that you just have to love doing. I mean, it's a lot of work. I don't do it professionally. I only use it in the only sort of cartooning or comics that I do are used in education or just for personal amusement. But I mean, if you, it's something that does take a lot of time, and to get it right and to do it well, it takes even more time.
Yeah. I mean, Ian, you're working on something too, right? I mean,
I decided like just last year that I needed to try to get more of a regular deadlines and regular goals for my comics, because I have them everywhere. They're just, they float, though. You know, they're in sketchbooks in one shelf. They're in, you know, and they're everywhere, and I'm always doing it. So I decided one thing I could do to just get me on the ball is to start, as corny as it sounds, doing the a monthly cartoon comic for my company's newsletter that goes out. And it's actually been really well received, and it's forced me to come up with constantly new material that's based on, you know, American pop culture. Because there's different offices around the world for my company, it's got to really apply to everyone. So it's been really good. And also, I was reading, you know, Will Eisner for a while was in the military doing, like, you know, diagrams of, like, Jeeps and mechanical parts, right?
Actually, he has a manual for the carbine that they issued to all the soldiers there. That's one of the most entertaining comics I've ever read.
Yeah. Really? So that kind of stuff, it's like, for me now, it's just been about getting a higher frequency of drawing. And I did get 50 strips done for a small book. The issue now is finding time to color them. So, yeah. Of course, I abandoned that for now, just with the wedding coming up. But I think it's slowly built. If you start building in deadlines for yourself that are realistic, where you could take the time and just put the comics more into your everyday life, that'll happen. But we're lucky too, man. We have digital publishing now. So it's like something that is maybe not a full-time job for us, but is part-time. We really have a big opportunity now to really see some money or just get it out there. So I've never been more excited for my own comic work. You know, in like this year, really alone, I've just been really psyched. You know.
Yeah.
That's. I mean, that's so true. I think that just being able to sit down and work without the procrastination, without the organizing your workspace or cleaning or doing the dishes, and there's always that thing that you kind of, I used to do that all of the time. I would sit down to do something, but then I'd be like, oh yeah, I gotta clean this, so I'll do that, and then it gets to be to the point where you just run out of time to write and you can't do that. But working at Ain't It Cool News, it's kind of gotten me to the point of where I can sit down and I can just write something like that, and there's not that hesitation. But it took a long time for me to develop that kind of regimen and that type of just skill to be able to sit down and write. It's hard to do, and I think I don't know if people really acknowledge the fact of procrastination and how common that is, and how that's like the biggest, I think that's the biggest enemy of a writer, of just like having other things to do and not being able to sit down and do that.
Or when you have a kid, it's being tired at the end of the day.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's, you know, I have my web comics, and but they've stalled as of late, and mostly it's just because so much personal and, you know, work stuff has come up. But I mean, I think that's what's good about sort of web comics, is that you can do it whenever you want. I mean, as a hobby, you know, and get it out there. And there's Facebook and Twitter, and you can be as aggressive as you want to be. You know, if you want to be really aggressive, there's obviously like huge success stories out there, you know, like PvP, you know, being like maybe the biggest one. But you know, I just think that, like you guys said, there's just a huge chance for anybody who wants to be involved in comics, you know, in any way, shape, or form. Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be print. You can use the internet as a tool, and then at some point, maybe, and that can also get you professional work. I mean, I would imagine if your web comic is good enough and solid enough, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. No, definitely. Yeah, it's just one of those things that if it's seen by the right person at the right time, that's all that matters. I think that it takes it's gonna take that time. It takes that kind of commitment to stick with it. But yeah, if you do that, hopefully it pays off. I mean, I think that's what every artist kind of hopes for, just that they're gonna put the work in there and someone's gonna notice it, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Hold on, we got Corey. I'm gonna try and get him in on this. Hold on, gentlemen. Hello.
Hey, Corey.
Hey, Corey.
Wow.
Late slacker.
I told you in my email.
Oh, you did? I didn't see an email. What did you say?
Just that I would be late.
All right. All right. Well, we were just going over like creator-owned comics and stuff like that, and Right now, we were just touching on the aspect of, you know, how sort of dedicated you have to be as far as, you know, maintaining a discipline. You got any thoughts on that?
You talking about self-publishing or just creator-owned? I mean,
just in general, just making comics in general.
Oh, well, yeah, it is completely disciplined and sort of isolating too, from what I understand. And so you really have to sort of reserve that time, really treat it as sort of precious time that you've got to schedule and so that you make sure you do it. I mean, it's so easy to just kind of, well, I got to go do laundry. I'll do it after that. And then you do laundry. Well, there's some bills I should do. And the Facebook's on like it's a TV show. So there's that part, and then there's also the business side too. I mean, if you're not with, I mean, I assume what we're talking about as far as the difference of just kind of going with a publisher is there's nobody to do the business end of it, which is the promotion, which is the paying people if you're just not you, if there's a team of you, and arranging how it's going to be distributed and where it's going to be distributed, and working with any sort of vendors or comic book stores, or if it's done digitally, if you have to work with Comixology or some other sort of digital service, if you're doing a web comic, you've got to work with WordPress and you've got to set up the whatever you use. It may not be WordPress, but whatever you use, you've got to figure out the internet side of it. You've got to figure out your internet presence. You've got to work on social marketing. And you've got to reach out to an audience so that people know that they have something that they can read. So
it's a
big job.
That's interesting. That as I just, because Mark, like when you were like pitching, I mean, I remember you at Comic-Con and you were like, I gotta go meet these guys, I'm gonna go pitch, I gotta go meet these guys. Did you ever think of like just doing a web comic or just like skipping it and just being like, screw this, I'm gonna do it on my own?
I mean, I think that I'm just under the firm belief that it's going to be, if I want to be successful, I got to develop a name for myself. And if I'm going to do that, I just have to work. I have to do something. So if, I don't know, there was a time when I wanted to do it online and just kind of like release it like a page a day and stuff like that. Yeah. But I think I do have projects that I've just been kind of like holding on to. And it's like, I want to work on some of the stuff that I'm doing right now with Zenoscope and some of the other stuff, but there are other things that I'm holding on to, and I don't even want to touch it yet. And one of these days, you know, if it happens, it happens. If the right kind of series of events goes through, that'd be great. If not, I just think that it's, but that's going to take some time first. No one's going to buy something from me because of just my name. They'll buy it because it's either a property that they recognize, or maybe an artist that they recognize, or something like that. And since I don't know too many artists as far as or anything like that, it's really tough. That's the other thing that's really tough as a writer, just trying to track down artists and trying to work with them. That's been a huge hurdle.
Is there some sort of, I guess, sort of clearinghouse that you can go to for artists, for lack of a better word?
It's interesting because at Comic-Con this year, and I heard about this after the fact, but I guess a friend of mine said that there was a kind of like a speed dating thing with writers and artists, and it wasn't even on the schedule, but you could basically go from one table to the next and just meet a bunch of artists and meet a bunch of writers, which is, I think that's a genius idea, and I hope next year they put it on the schedule so that I could actually hear about it ahead of time and plan to go. Yeah. The person that went said that there wasn't a lot of stuff there were a couple of really good artists, but really it ranges from just someone who has like a trapper keeper full of sketches to someone with a real portfolio. So it's a crapshoot.
One thing for online that I think is a good resource is DeviantArt.
Yeah.
And that's you know, again, you're going to get a wide range of levels and experiences, and it takes, you know, it's a big thing to kind of sort through, but it's you can find some pretty talented people.
Yeah, I know that Kirkman, a long time ago, I read an interview with him, and he said, and I don't know if, I don't even know the name of the site, but he said he found Corey Walker, the original artist on Invincible, and I can't remember the original artist for Walking Dead, but he found them online. I don't know how or what site, but he found them, and he got lucky. They just turned out to be dudes who, you know, were dependable and, you know, had it in their schedule and stuff like that, and, you know, just could pump out pages, you know, and get them going. So
I remember digital webbing being a really good resource for a little while there, but it's kind of, I haven't looked at it in a while. I don't even know if, I think they still publish stuff maybe, but I don't think they're still a.
Is that still around? Wow.
Yeah, I don't even know if, I don't know what the status of that is.
Digital webbing.
Did you guys see at Artist Alley this year at San Diego? They had that giant screen up there just showing random pictures and drawings from people from DeviantArt. And it gave their information at the end. I thought that was genius. That was really, really cool.
Oh, that's cool. I think the first time they did that was maybe WonderCon or something last year.
Oh, yeah. They did that at WonderCon. Yeah, yeah.
That's awesome they did it again. I didn't know that. That's
yeah,
great.
Yeah. Like, if you could get away from the Hasbro booth or whatever video game booth was, you know. But I did see that, and I thought that was really, really cool. I wonder if it was specifically who were people who were at the show, or was it just DeviantArt in general? Because, I mean, either way, it's a fantastic idea. And I've gone on DeviantArt and gotten extremely depressed from looking at how good some of the artwork is on there. You know, you're just like, geez, it's amazing. But yeah, I guess what it all comes down to is dedication. And I would imagine that these guys who are jumping ship from Marvel and DC, and we were kind of talking about that earlier, Corey, that, you know, I would imagine that maybe they've just saved all their money up and, you know, are just going off on their own, or, you know, cashing in their residual checks. I mean, Corey, do you know anything about that? Like, have you heard anything about these guys who? Because my big one was Brubaker, but
I think it's, well, I mean, it's hard to know for sure. But I think there's a few things kind of happening that are making it more enticing for them to make this shift. One of course being that there is just more buzz around creator ownership in general. I mean, just look at Walking Dead. I mean, that's like enough of an argument for a lot of people right there, the success that he's had. And another thing is that if you kind of look at the transition that Marvel and DC are going through, where they are really, they're becoming more corporate in a sense, and more driven by the studios and more driven by their parent companies. And you hear these stories of George Perez, you know, just desperately wanting his Superman run to be over because he just can't stand it, because they just don't trust him to write the story that he pitched them, and all the meddling that he went through, and you know, which is the same story you heard from other creators that are involved in the New 52, and certainly these aren't new stories, but I think they seem to be more pronounced now, and so I think there's just been a general gradual shift over the last 10 years. Where people, creators who are used to, who have been used to having a lot of trust given to them and a lot of autonomy to a certain degree. I mean, obviously they still work with the editors, but when you have editorial notes coming from executives higher up over the editors, I think it's just, and you are constantly getting second guessed, and their decisions are getting second guessed. There's an atmosphere eventually where creativity doesn't feel as welcome for these for people who are used to having had more freedom. So
I'm sorry to cut you off. No, I just think that there's that enticement, but there are people who really want to tell stories and stories that matter and stories that have that make waves and actually seem like they are actually relevant. But it seems like in a world like with DC and Marvel, with everything going back to status quo by the end of the story, that's really not very attractive to want to write something. On the other hand, though, I think that people really want to, it's like everybody wants to make their Frank Miller Born Again Daredevil arc. So it's like, why can't you tell tell an ongoing story and tell a serial type story where you can where it's just a fun. It doesn't have to be earth shattering. You know, I think that there's something to that. That's been a lost talent. I think that people just don't want to do that anymore. Everybody wants to write a year one story or a born again.
I also probably feel that a lot of these guys are probably getting tired and bored of doing the same old stories, you know. They're of working with the same old characters, and they want to do something new. Again, like I go back to Grant Morrison. I mean, this guy's got a huge imagination. If you read The Invisibles or The Filth or something like that, you see the scope of this guy's insanity / genius. And you know, he's been doing Superman and Batman for the last three years or something.
He's also said in the press that he's been wanting to do Superman for a long time, right?
Yeah. I mean, he alternates between not wanting to do superheroes and then and then something capturing his imagination and him wanting to do superheroes.
Well,
you know? But you know, that's, I think to a degree, that's why people are going to be jumping off and doing their own stories, because, you know, a lot of those stories have already been done.
Yeah,
Marvel and DC have been very lucky in that they do have these wonderful characters that almost all of us have grown up with and loved, and as have the creators that are working on them today. And so they get a lot of rope from people who would probably not put up with the environment that they might have to put up with. To get to sort of live that childhood dream of writing these characters.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think, you know, once you scratch that itch, you're kind of like, yeah, but I still had more fun doing my own thing. And so then they eventually go back to doing their own thing again.
Yeah. Well, I think that part of, there's a couple of things to like take into account, which is like, you know, Grant Morrison, he used to, what's the name of that? I was trying to think of it before, Corey, but he used to write an article for Comic Book Resources and he stopped. He collected them in a book and I can't remember.
No, that was Warren Ellis. It was called Coming Alone.
Okay, Warren Ellis. Okay, so then basically those guys should be following Warren Ellis's advice, because I mean, his big thing was like, I remember reading this and being like, oh yeah. And it's something that Joss Whedon does, and it's something that, well, a lot of other big creators do. It's like you go off, and if he basically said, if you want to write Superman, forget about writing Superman. Create a character that's like Superman, isn't exactly like Superman, but he's Superman enough, you know. And then you'll get that Jones out and you will own him and you will get all the money that you want from him, and then you'll be able to cash in your chips, which is basically, to a certain extent, you know, if you look at the Joss Whedon comparison, you know, to me, Buffy was always Spider-Man, sort of like the wisecracking teenage hero who had a group of friends and there was always some kind of drama going on. You know, that to me was the template for Spider-Man. And then you've got, you know, Angel, which was, you know, the dark, brooding guy in the trench coat who fought at night. Well, who's that? That's Batman, you know what I mean? And he's got his Alfred and he's got his Robin. You know, they're not exactly the same sort of thing, but, you know, he's obviously doing comic book templates. And then, but I think also the other thing that you need to look at too is that, you know, these characters, it's sort of the argument that people get into, and I'm on the Kirby family side, and I'm on the Siegel and Schuster family side, I'm on the Alan Moore side, you know, of all these creator-owned arguments. But the thing that you have to realize is that Superman's been around for 75 years, Spider-Man's been around for 50 years, and it's not only because of the writer and artist that they've been around for that long. There's been, as douchey as it seems to for me to say, and as schizophrenic as it seems to me to say, you have to think, like, there is a reason that these corporate characters have been around, and it's because there's been a corporate structure to be making action figures out of them, to be putting them in coloring books, to be making TV shows out of them. You know, there's a whole reason. I mean, would Superman still have been around today? I mean, look at the Spirit. The Spirit is still around, but he's nowhere near as well known as Batman. He's nowhere near well as known as you know, Spider-Man. I mean, I'm sure Will Eisner is happier because, you know, he made whatever money he had to make off of that and his family. But I'm just saying, like, there's sort of an argument, I mean, not to be made, but there is a reason that these characters have been around, and it's beyond the fact that, you know, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby did an awesome Galactus arc that blew our minds, you know, when we were kids, you know, and then the final point I kind of want to make, you know, on this kind of rant is that I think, I mean, when you guys were kids, did you get this sense that Marvel and DC, like, why aren't you guys making an amusement park out of Spider-Man? And why aren't you guys, like, using these characters to make money? I think in the past, like, 5 years, especially now that Marvel's at Disney, you know, I think they've opened their eyes and they've been like, wait a minute, there's money to be made here. You know what I mean? Like, we can build action figures. I mean, Marvel's always kind of been doing that, but... You know, I think that they've gone outside the boxes, just seeing these things as things to make stories with, and now they can go beyond that. They can make movies, and that's become a bigger part of the equation. Whereas,
yeah,
like,
they can make Broadway shows too.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
And I think they've gone too far, because once you have people dying on Broadway shows that are about your character, you pretty much push the envelope too far. And I mean, structure-wise, it's interesting. We're talking about artists here, right? We're talking about people that follow their ideas, I think, as ideally as it may sound. But they might just want more. And the trend that I guess I've seen in my two cents is that as these corporate places become more corporate, you have certain people placed in between other people that might make your day a little bit harder. So, like... For instance, if you're back in the day and you're drawing in a bullpen, you know the guy who's running that bullpen has probably been sitting there for a bit, and he's got real skill. Because the way I think it worked was that, you know, you would have one guy that would kind of dictate the style, right? And then there'd be kind of a built-in system where people could learn from each other in that way. But corporate style's different. You might have some person who knows nothing, who might be managing certain groups, et cetera, and it just might be more difficult. It might just be a headache. You know,
yeah.
I don't know if I'm just taking stabs in the dark, but I do hear it from other industries all the time. I hear it from my guys who shoot, you know, on sets. You know, they have really young, immature talent that can kind of get over on your craft. And I think if you care about making craft and you really care about making stories and writing something that's great that you care about and drawing something that's great that you care about, sometimes the corporate stuff just gets in your way and you got to throw your arms off and up and walk away.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's what maybe creators are sort of doing, is like, you got to get past that love of this character, this love of Superman or whatever you had when you were a little kid, and try and move off to your own. But again, maybe if you don't have that huge corporate money backing you, you know, your character's not going to be in a movie, or your character's not going to have action figures. Or, I mean, look at almost every small company that's tried to do superheroes, not even superheroes, in the past 10, 15, 20 years. Have they survived? I mean,
what are you looking at? I mean, I think you make a good point, but I think also if you look at the larger sort of financial structure that was around the comics industry, and the economic structure and the way culture just worked in general, I mean, there was no such thing as a creator-owned comic book character outside of, I suppose, the Spirit, and I would argue that Will Eisner probably just wanted to do something different. And I don't think that character's longevity had to do with the failings of the absence of a corporate structure pushing it. If you look at Bone, I think that's done quite well. If you look at, you know, and then you can look at Cerebus, but I think when you see who's behind that and his sort of limited ability to engage people, I think, you know, that's why that character hasn't grown much. So had he sold that to a company, or had he made that at Marvel or DC, maybe that character would have been bigger, perhaps.
But he would not have been able to tell anywhere near the stories that he wanted to tell.
Absolutely.
And I guess that's what it comes down to, right?
Yeah, and I think so. And I think if you look at Walking Dead, Walking Dead is a huge TV show and is doing gangbusters in the bookstores. I think the fact that there's no Marvel or DC that was pushing that is not a problem at all.
Yeah.
I think it's a little bit case by case, but I think it's also a little bit of... Currently, now we're in the world is just different, where there's more ability for a creator to push something to a level that could be, because, you know, if you look to Superman in 1938, I mean, who was making anything close to The Walking Dead at that time? It just didn't exist. Or even, you know, even Spider-Man. You know, the closest you got was R. Crumb or something like that. So, who were completely anti-commercial, I think if you saw, you know, I mean, I guess you did see some movies from their work, but I think if you saw the commercialization of something from somebody like an R. Crumb, I think a lot of people would be calling shenanigans for being pretty disingenuous. So sure. I think now we're just arriving at a place where you can take advantage of a property without that corporate structure.
Huh.
Yeah, one of the things that I've just noticed lately, and we've talked about this on Pop-Tarts podcast that we do, is that there are so many number one books coming out right now. It does feel a little bit like a glut of just like there's just everything. Image has like two or three new number ones every month, it seems, and it is getting a. There's only so much money that can go around, and so many people, so many comic book readers out there. So it's, I don't know. I think that people have taken Kirkman and Brubaker's lead. I don't know. I don't see any of these new number ones sustaining past, like, I don't know, 5-6 issues. You know, there's not gonna. It doesn't seem like that can happen, especially with.
There's a certain amount of like alchemy that sort of needs to happen with any project. You know, it has to be the right artist, the right writer, the right audience at the time. And, you know, that's part of, I think, a lot of what we see going on out there is, you know, sort of the failed attempt. And maybe someone, you know, will, you know, with the persistence that, you know, Mark was talking about earlier, they'll hit that exact combination and break through. But we have to the disappointing thing in a way about the internet is that we sort of get to see a lot of the failed stuff, and it's out there publicly now. It wasn't there before.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I just think but do you guys get the feeling that maybe a creator-owned project needs to be finite? I mean, that it can't be like what sort of Superman and Spider-Man have been, where it's just like it goes on forever and ever and ever and ever, and it just never stops. Like, do you get the feeling? Because to me, it seems like there, I went through a period where I was really big into manga, you know. And there's did you just laugh, Mark?
No.
Oh, sorry, I thought I heard you laugh. I heard somebody laugh at my love of manga. Stop it! No, but I went through a period of, and I still do. There's certain titles that I still love, but I started seeing a trend where it's like they would maybe get to 20 books or 25 books, and obviously there's stuff like Naruto, which is still going on strong, but you know, it seems like. With the manga, the creators would like tell their story. Maybe it would take a long time, but then they were done. They would end, and that would be it. Like, and then I was talking to a guy at Comic-Con, which is a book that I want to review this week for Ain't It Cool. This book called Gorillas, and which I love. I love this book. But this guy, I was talking to him, and I was like, "How many volumes are there going to be? Because there's only two so far." And he's like, "There's probably only going to be three." And I see this sort of like as a trend where. You know, and it seems like it's not happening with Walking Dead. It seems like Kirkman's just dragging that out, you know, milking that cow. But do you think that a creator-owned book needs to be finite? Or, like, because, I mean, Garfield is still going, and that guy's not drawing the book. Dagwood, I'm talking about comic strips, you know.
Look at Gru. Gru has been going on for years and years and years, and it doesn't seem like that's ever going to stop. I mean, it'll stop when maybe Sergio Aragon is... isn't living anymore, but who knows? I'm sure the character will still continue after that. It's just one of those characters that's more of a serial. And I think that you're right. I think it does seem like that's the trend of just having things just be maybe at the very most like a 20 issue thing, or maybe even a 12 issue thing or a 4 issue. You don't see too many things like Garth Ennis's The Boys. That is coming to an end. It seems like those are the ones that are more admirable because it seems like there is a plan. I think with Kirkman, the reason why he's getting so much heat is because he doesn't seem like he has a plan. It seems like he's just going to have these guys wandering around, getting into trouble, coming out with a few less of the cast members, and then meeting new cast members on and on and on until, I guess, forever. And I think that there is a want for the end of it, but I really don't want the series to end. I don't know about you guys. Do you guys feel that it should end at some point?
With Walking Dead, yeah. I think there needs to be an ending.
Yeah, absolutely. I think with the exception of, you know, the DC and Marvel things that we've been talking about that are sort of like open-ended in a way, most stories benefit from having an ending.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
I'm sure Kirkman has an idea of where he's going to be going with this and how it's going to end up, but I think it would be really interesting, and it would be a really ballsy move if Kirkman would just forget Rick and those guys for a little while and follow someone else.
Sure. Or kill Rick off. I mean, well, to me, the Walking Dead has always been about Rick. So
yeah.
I think if you kill that character, I think that should be the end. And then if you wanted to start a new series, you know, but then you learn the story of, like, but then it's like you've got the situation where you've got Wolverine, right? You can't kill Wolverine. You could never kill Wolverine, you know, or Spider-Man. You can never kill. So is Kirkman sort of, you know, going to keep, I mean, as long as he can, keep that book going? You know, with Rick.
He's said that that's what he wants to do. Is, I mean, he wants to do issue 1000. I mean, he doesn't want it to end. He wants it to keep going.
Well, then do you think he could pull it off with it being Rick's story? I mean, are we going to have Rick as an old man wandering the zombie apocalypse? Like, you know,
I've always kind of imagined, and I haven't read the most. I think I'm maybe a trade behind, but I've always imagined that that eventually it would transition to Rick, from Rick to his son.
Smart.
Well, you know, he did release that book earlier this year, The Rise of the Governor, and that was pretty interesting. I read that book, and it was actually not a bad read. I would love to hear Michonne's story. I think she's a character who has been just really so quiet and in the background that I think that would be an interesting person to follow as well. But she's kind of like a Wolverine character too.
Yeah. Like, if you kill her off, then it's like... But it's really interesting because, I mean, we could get on a discussion of Wolverine, and that could be like a whole other podcast. But I think, in my opinion, Wolverine is such a basic character that it's like, kill him, remix, new costume. Okay, now you've got a killing sociopath who's in love with a Japanese girl. Like, I think if you wanted to kill Wolverine, it would be easy to do and pop up another character in his place that you
Wolverine's
can make just
been
as
killed
popular.
Many, many times in a way, because that character, he's not the same character from writer to writer.
That's true.
Not like Superman. Like, Wolverine actually changes personalities, to become a completely different character.
That's true.
I love it when writers write it with a country accent. It's just it annoys the shit out of me when they do that.
He's
Sorry.
Country.
Yeah.
He's a cowboy.
They talk him like he's a cowboy, but
he's
it's
a Canadian
like,
cowboy.
Reason.
Cool. Well.
Or when they overdo the A's, like they overdo the Canadian part of it. As well.
He's Canadian. Do they do that? I never noticed that. Oh my God.
Sometimes it just depends on what the writer. I think.
Well. I think what we're looking at is just a really new and interesting landscape, and I'm really interested to see what happens with Marvel and DC in the next couple of years. And I mean, I'm excited. I love all the Image books that they've been coming out with. I've been trying to pick as many up as I can. I picked up Danger Club, you know, I picked up Glory, which is a Liefeld creation, but he's got somebody else writing and illustrating it. And I think, to me, Image has been doing a bang up job lately, and whether those books go on forever, I doubt that they will. But you know, I think that's a company that's just kind of them and IDW, maybe to a certain extent, although they're doing mostly licensed properties. They just seem to be pushing like the creator owned thing as far as they can. You know, I don't know. So, but all right. Well, anyone have any last thoughts on creators leaving corporate books or just creating comics in general?
You can't kill Wolverine as a healing factor.
Yeah. All right.
I think they all should leave and let us come in and have jobs there.
Yes.
Yay. We'll
in
take
conclusion.
Over. In conclusion, hire the part-time fanboy crew to write all of your comics. and pay us
and
good
don't
money.
Don't forget Ben. He likes to write too.
Oh, God.
All right, well, that's so I can draw.
All right.
I'm writing in my cell.
Here we go with the Bane voice. Everybody do it. All right. Well, this has been another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. Please check us out at parttimefanboy.com. Like us on Twitter. I mean, like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. You know what I'm talking about. And send us an email at ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Thanks for sitting in, everyone, and hopefully we'll do this again next week.
Part-Time Fanboy.
All right, yeah. Let me do the intro, and we'll see if we can survive this, if my ulcer can do this. All right, so this is Part-Time Fanboy. All right, so Ian was just, I was just going to record a couple of minutes of Ian telling me why he liked The Dark Knight Returns. I mean,
sounds good.
Rises, and I figured since you were already online, you could join in a little and see. So what? So Ian, you liked it, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the day it was crazy because Friday I'm like, all right, I got to get tickets, and it seems a lot of the like movie ticket sites have, I guess, released their power to the actual movie theater sites as far as, you know, getting seats, right?
Yeah.
So like some tickets are held back, but my one buddy at work was like, I'll hook you up. So he's like, go to the ArcLight. So I get like early show ArcLight. I'm planning everything. I'm like, I'm not gonna drink an hour before I go in. Because I don't want to be able to go, you know, I don't want to go to the bathroom. And I'm like, I'm bringing in food. I cooked up like a couple hot dogs, you know, ketchup, mustard. I had carrot sticks with me. I had an apple with me. And I had seltzer. And I had planned like time eating sessions throughout the movie just so I would never have to leave. Because, you know, Nolan is known to sneak in like a little scene, and that'll ruin your whole movie if you don't catch it. Yeah. So I'm like, all right, I'm going in strong. The theater wasn't crowded. I sat right in the middle, and I just let it go. I mean, it was just me sitting there. There was definitely, like, my first impressions were I just liked it. Like, I left the theater. I felt really good. I love how the ending, it definitely welled me up with some Batman emotions that I haven't felt in a while, you know, that were really sweet. And this was the best day, though, because when I left, like, the theater all high on Batman, I got in. And the three story arc, the three pay issue detective arc that Paul told me about,
yeah,
that arrived on my doorstep when I came in.
Nice.
So I'm like, all right, now I'll just read some Batman comics. So then I spent the afternoon reading those three stories, and I was just like, this is the best Batman day ever. So in general, though, I love that they added more humor. I thought this one was definitely a little more lighter. Even the darkness and tone. While there were great blacks, like, I thought a lot of this stuff was shot more in daylight, and you could just see more. And I thought the cast was great. I you know, Michael Caine, really, in the first half of that movie, or the first, I guess, what would you guys say? He was in, like, the first third or first half?
He was not in the first half.
I'd say the first third, yeah.
Okay, I just thought he was, like, the rock as far as, like, rooting that movie. In the first, you know, just setting it up, and it's like, what a better, you know, you can't have a better actor just kind of being, I thought he was really like the pivot man in that first, you know, act. Gordon, even though he was in the bed, which I was kind of disappointed, you know, about, I was just glad he started doing stuff. They didn't chump him out, you know, and he got his good moments. You know, Bane, I thought they elevated the character. I mean, the voice thing is beyond me, guys. Like, I don't know.
Ian, what? You didn't like my voice in the movie of the Dark Knight Rises?
It's just beyond me. I'm not sure what I think about it.
Batman, I'm so sinister with this voice.
Well, just... at least he didn't do the luchador voice from the animated series.
Oh, gosh, I can't even remember that voice.
That was crazy, but, I mean, he was just, you know... I thought it was very good at what it was. I mean, it was interesting how the movie kept rewriting itself with the way the story of Bane or the child that left this prison, you know, like it kept revisiting it, and there was like, you know, three or four different stories about how this came to be. And I did not read any spoilers, so I really got hooked in when it was, oh, frig, it's Talia al Ghul is there. And the movie is so dense. And it's like, the one fault I guess I would have, and I was just talking to my buddy about this, was the prison was like, I really had to let a lot of stuff go there, because it's like,
dude,
one.
There is more, the more I think about the plot and the story of this movie, yeah. Like this past week, the more I'm like, there's a lot you have to let go.
You have
a
to
lot.
Let it go. He basically was cured of his back issue by a palm strike. A palm strike to the back?
A chiropractor who got his degree at the local university of the cell that I've been trapped in for
the past 30
years.
He got his degree in hell.
In hell. Oh, my gosh. And then, yeah, that's fine. I'm glad you like it. I don't want anyone to have a bad movie experience. But for me, I just thought it was too dense. I thought there was too much stuff going on, and it didn't really kick in for me. Till a certain point of the movie, and even when it did, I was just like, oh, come on. You know, like the whole stock exchange scene, the biggest thing.
Yeah.
And then the next day they find out that Bruce Wayne ran his fingerprints at the exact same time on the stock exchange that Bane and his terrorists were taking it over and somehow made a trade. It just makes no sense. It's like...
That's real heavy, heavy stuff. I mean, it's like, it's really like Jap Animation does that all the time. You'll get these major plot points in the span of 5 seconds, and you're like, you have to accept it, or the rest of the movie's going to be trouble for you. And I have a really big pet peeve, actually, and it had to do with that jail sequence. I have a really big pet peeve with movies that throw a random generic, like, Middle Easterner old guy who's, like, half-blind in... Like, you know, who will mumble and just be in the jail, and you're supposed to believe like he's some sort of gypsy, or he's just speaking in proverbs, and the funny thing too was the jail comes with a half naked man whose sole job is to spot people with a rope when they decide.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. I think that this movie,
a guy's got to make a living even in jail. Okay.
I think that this movie, quite honestly, is going to be like Superman Returns. When Superman Returns, there were a lot of comic fans that were like, ooh, it's so good, it's so... And then like 6 months later, every podcast, every article was just picking it apart. And that's going to start happening with this movie, because even a week later, I'm like...
It may happen to it, but it's no Superman Returns.
No, it is no... It is better, far better than Superman Returns, but you can just pick that movie apart. You don't even need to try, so... Anyway, I'm going to try and get... So Ian liked it, Paul liked it, Christian didn't hate it, was like, meh. And I'm sure I'm going to hear from some of the others that we get on.
Hey, did anyone... So I guess you all saw Batman, right?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah.
Did anyone feel like... For a second there, I thought it was going to be that... it sounded like Liam Neeson's voice coming out of Bane's mouth. I thought it would have been kind of cool to have it like... be Ra's al Ghul talking through that little microphone in his face.
Oh my god.
I thought it sounded like his voice for most of the time, so I thought there was going to be like
it really
twist.
Changed. It really changed throughout the movie. I mean, in the beginning it was like super stereo, and then it kept going. I mean, I read a couple people that were like, it's Sean Connery, and then I'm like, it was Sean Connery? But it went... Yeah, went everywhere.
It also sounded a little bit like Liam Neeson, I thought. It just had that, I guess, Scottish kind of... Is he Scottish? I don't even know.
I don't know, but it sounded like Mr. Magoo to me.
hell of a reveal if he, pulled off the mask and it was Sean Connery under there.
Yes, it's just a little mini Sean Connery.
The nice thing about the Bane voice is that everyone can do it, and even if everyone does it different, it sounds fun.
It sounds just like him.
Everyone has a Sean Connery impression. That's the reason why.
Yeah. Oh my goodness!
All right. Now, dog.
just cup your hands and get some reverb in there.
I mean, it was all right. It just, oh god, it could have been two movies.
Yeah.
I kind of think they should have started it. They should have done one of those. I forget the Latin term, but in mid resium or whatever they call it.
Media reus. Yeah.
Yeah, where they just start with. Everything's Gotham's cut off, and then do some flashbacks to explain how we got there, and then go.
Or start with him in the prison.
Yeah, start with him in the prison and Gotham, in no man's land, which I assume that's what that was referencing, right?
Yeah,
and just go from there. Cause it was,
good idea. That would have been interesting because that would have been kind of a mirror image of what how Batman Begins started out.
And I think there's a lot of it is them trying to bookend.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very smart. See, hire us for your comic
book. That's right.
Yeah. I think that's a really smart idea because to me it would have it would have gotten my big thing was like, where's fucking Batman? come on, give me Batman, it's a small thing in a movie called Batman, The Dark Knight Rises or whatever, but anyway, that's very really smart. That would have been a good way to go. Cool.